A few weeks back, I was watching the first Democratic presidential debate. Just before the closing statements, moderator Anderson Cooper posed this question to the candidates.
Governor Chafee, Franklin Delano Roosevelt once said, "I ask you to judge me by the enemies I have made." You've all made a few people upset over your political careers. Which enemy are you most proud of?
Lincoln Chafee answered he was proud to have the coal lobby as his enemy. Martin O'Malley said his enemy was the National Rifle Association. Then,
Secretary Clinton?
Well, in addition to the NRA, the health insurance companies, the drug companies, the Iranians, probably the Republicans.
Clinton beamed as if wearing a Republicans are the enemy badge of honor. And this got me to thinking, Hillary's enemies make up 42% of the country, according to a Gallup poll. That's about 133 million Americans. Or is she just referring to Republican politicians? But Hillary's not alone in knowing her enemies. Rush Limbaugh freely tosses around the E-word as well.
Always cut and run from America's foreign enemies. But if the Republicans are going to now start cutting and running from our domestic enemies, and that's the Democrats, then we've got a big problem. This
is casting Democrats as the enemy is part of Rush's act. But the word enemy, it makes me think of war, of people whom we wish to mortally harm, those who represent darkness in an epic battle of good and evil, like Hitler, Stalin, or Osama bin Laden. But Republicans and Democrats? Both parties claim to be doing what's best for Americans, and both try to sanctify their speeches by asking God to bless this country, even though they say or act like many of their fellow citizens are their enemies.
Thank you all. God bless you. And may God bless America.
In the Bible, Jesus advises his followers to love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. In a time when politicians are proud of the divide between us and them, is it possible to love one's enemies? From West Virginia Public Broadcasting, this is Us and Them, the podcast where we explore America's cultural divides. I'm Trey Kay. Love your enemy. It seems like a lofty goal. Besides, if we loved our enemies, would they still be our enemies? And what if we downshift from loving our enemies to merely communicating with them? We certainly can't look to Congress for guidance on how to talk to our enemies. I'm not talking about the evil kind either, just those who have different perspectives from us. Media outlets express surprise when Congress actually agrees upon something.
Here's something we haven't seen in a while. Top Republicans and Democrats in Washington agree on something. That something is a temporary truce on the budget that would lift the threat of a government shutdown or a debt default.
Government shutdown averted, but that doesn't make bipartisanship the status quo. In fact, it often seems like a dirty word.
There's no compromise on repealing Obamacare lock, stock, and barrel. There's going to be no compromise on supporting.
Will the two sides just wait each other out until one side cries uncle? To help me better understand this dynamic, I talked to this guy.
My name's Adam Lotz. I'm a historian at Binghamton University, and I study educational culture wars.
Lotz is an academic, but I know him best from his blog, I Love You, But You're Going to Hell. Here, I'll let him tell you how that came about.
Well, a few years back, I had a student who told me this story. She said she was at some kind of family thing, and some old lady relative said, "Come here, honey." So she went over there and thinking, okay, I'll help her to her car or something, I don't know. And so my student is helping her get her coat on and her bag and whatnot. It's winter in upstate New York. And the older woman says, "Honey, there's something I have to tell you. I'm troubled." "And well, what is it?" "I love you, but you're going to hell." And
Why did she say that?
Well, that's exactly my student. She was so angry when she came to me. And for, I think, a lot of conservative religious people, there is this sentiment that they mean as the ultimate sort of ironic gesture. You know, I'm trying to help you. I want to tell you I love you, but you're going to hell.
The funny thing is, the student didn't even know how she was related to this lady. She figured it was a distant relative.
Apparently, the mother had told this older lady that my student was living with her boyfriend. So to the aunt lady, my student was living a life of sin, you know, giving into carnal temptation and having sex out of wedlock and things like this. And to my student, you know, she was in a monogamous relationship. You know, she didn't drink, she didn't smoke. You know, she was a do-gooder. She was trained to be a special ed teacher. She volunteered in an after-school literacy program. She was a very moral person, you know, and she was just flummoxed by, why would this seemingly so nice lady, and I'm helping her put her coat on, why would she say such a horrible, horrible, hurtful thing?
And voila, a blog was born. I love you, but you're going to hell. A blog that focuses on, quote, awkward conversations about school and society.
The blog is an attempt for me to understand how someone, a religious conservative, could say that to somebody and not mean it in a horrible, hateful way, but rather mean it sincerely. I'm doing what I can to help you. I love you. Therefore, I have to tell you, what you're doing is sending your soul to hell.
And I'm sure that perhaps your student never came around to maybe hearing the loving gesture that might have been behind that, or the real heartfelt concern that this elder woman felt. Mm-hmm. But I guess what you're saying is that, is it your objective that maybe people on either side of the culture war divide need to be able to listen to that message that they're not hearing? Like, for instance, your student heard the you're going to hell more than she heard the I love you.
Mm-hmm. And then the I love you just seemed like mean, you know, like a fake, an insult. I think more important than winning particular fights in culture war would be the idea that we all should first try to understand the best version of what people on the other side might mean.
Lott says it's too easy to label people with opposing views as crazy old ladies, or evil, bigoted, lazy, us, them, etc. Labels help us organize the world along fault lines. Who is with us? Who is with them? Or to put it in stronger terms, who is our friend and who is our enemy? This approach may keep things simple, but it also hinders us from learning about others.
There's no Darth Vader here. What I try to do is what I think of as the more important task of saying, why, from their perspective, are they right? They're smart, and they're intelligent, and they're educated, and yet they believe these things that seem so outlandish to me. And without assuming that we are going to abandon our own beliefs, or that the people that we don't agree with are going to abandon their beliefs, the most important thing to not just realize, but to work at, is that some of the people with whom we disagree are doing the same thing from a different moral background, but they're doing the same thing that we like to think we're doing. They're working not for their own self-interest, but to help other people.
It's good to be reminded of this. I'm guilty of seeing Darth Vader sometimes when I come across people whose views I don't agree with. But if my goal is to engage civilly, then assuming the person is Darth Vader probably shouldn't be my default setting. But we have a history in this nation of being suspicious of our neighbors, of questioning their loyalty as Americans. The trend reaches back to the beginning of the country. Even before the colonies declared independence, royalists and patriots viewed each other as traitors. In the 19th century, abolitionists squared off with slave owners, leading to a tear restitched only through civil war. Not even 100 years later, Senator Joseph McCarthy fueled the fear sparked by the Cold War with his campaign to root out communists from the halls of government, the military, and Hollywood. Here's the senator from a 1953 broadcast of Meet the Press.
Any man who has been named by either a senator or a committee or a congressman as dangerous to the welfare of this nation, his name should be submitted to the various intelligence units, and they should conduct a complete check upon him.
Thousands of Americans were wrongly accused of being communists during McCarthy's reign. He made such a stain on history that McCarthyism is now in the dictionary. It's a noun that means the practice of making unfair allegations or use of unfair investigative techniques, especially in order to restrict dissent or political criticism. We no longer fear that our neighbors are communists, but the idea that our enemies are among us has not gone away. Some religious leaders allege their opponents on social issues are responsible not only for our moral decline, but for acts of terrorism. This is the late Reverend Jerry Falwell, shortly after 9/11.
I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
Maybe there is something instinctual in us, a need to blame someone when things go wrong. So we declare our enemies and point our fingers. But is this the best policy? Or in 2015, should we try harder to understand our enemies? Some people don't think so. In the first episode of Us and Them, I talked about my sometimes contentious but usually loving friendship with a conservative Christian woman, Alice Moore. That episode sparked a discussion on the blog I Love You, But You're Going to Hell. Adam Lotz posed this question.
Is it worth talking to someone with whom we have fundamental disagreements, culture war disagreements?
We scroll through the comments, and there's a post from this guy who calls himself John Olin. He makes a distinction between Americans and liberals, meaning liberals are not Americans. And he writes, unless one side is open to being converted, then...
I see no point in such conversations. Why would I waste my time and energy on conversing with the enemy? It was rough. That's a rough sentiment.
What do you think of that?
Well, if and when people will say that stuff, it means that they're not willing to have a conversation. Instead, they're going to want to win the fight.
But what Jonathan says is that there's an argument between Americans and liberals. Mm. Golly, I mean, first of all, I think of, you know, where I am on the political scale is relative to who I'm speaking with. Mm-hmm. There are people who are my friends who make me feel very conservative. And then there are people who make me feel very liberal. And so it's very difficult for me to, you know, say I am clearly a rock ribbed conservative or I'm a lefty bleeding heart liberal. I can't say that because I feel like it really is relative. But this person, Jonathan, basically said that I am a liberal and therefore I am not an American.
Not an American.
But Lotz admits he also struggles with labeling people as the enemy. I interviewed him just before the landmark Supreme Court ruling that made same-sex marriage legal. Lotz says he realized he was pigeonholing those who oppose marriage between consenting adults.
I find myself thinking of those people as bigots. They are trying to push people out of basic civil rights in this case. In this case, marriage is the most obvious, but also just the human right of having a sexual relationship. So when I say, I don't say it, but could I say there are people who agree with me, and then there are bigots? And bigot is a tough word. And I think that sentiment is something like saying there's Americans and there's liberals. Because if someone is a bigot, we've pushed that person out of polite society. And I know for a fact that there are people that I have a lot of respect for, smart people, smart, educated people, hyper-educated in some cases, who have this belief. They think that homosexual practice is sinful. And so my challenge to myself is to say, I'm not going to agree with them. But if I just write off people who believe that as simply bigots, and it's difficult because for me it's very personal, then I'm doing what Jonathan did, which is taking people, lumping them into an undifferentiated mass and labeling them to push them out of the possibility of being part of our cultural conversation.
I can easily see when my opponents attempt to lump me or my side into an undifferentiated mass. but I don't always see when I'm guilty of the same blanket demonization. So how do we go about making friends with our enemies? Or at least not hating them so much?
I think when it comes to communication, us and them, not us versus them, it takes a certain kind of dedication on both sides. Our goal can't be to just, we're doing this as a simple strategy to convince, you know, one person at a time.
Lotz says we need to know we're not going to have our way in every conversation. And this makes me think of a comment Vice President Joe Biden recently made at a gala before an audience of Washington elites. He recalled a lesson he learned as a freshman senator.
It's always, always appropriate to challenge another man or woman's judgment. It's never, never appropriate to challenge their motive because you just don't know. And one of the reasons why it's so hard to govern today is that it's almost impossible, ladies and gentlemen, to reach consensus if you accuse someone else of being unethical or in someone's pocket or someone is that they are not decent individuals. It's hard ever to get to yes.
Political pundits viewed Biden's statement as a rebuke of Hillary Clinton's claim that Republicans are her enemies.
It is possible. It is necessary to end this notion that the enemy is the other party. End this notion that it's naive to think we can speak well of the other party and cooperate. What is naive is to think it's remotely possible to govern this country unless we can. That is what is naive.
So where do we begin to fight this naivety, our real enemy? And who is going to dive in first? Or are we just going to do it on the count of three? So who is your enemy? And how did you choose her or him? Have you defeated your enemy only to find him pop up again in a game of whack-a-mole? Tell us about your enemies on Facebook or Twitter or on the feedback section of our website, the links for which are at usandthempodcast.com. That's usandthempodcast.com. And do us a favor and rate our program on iTunes. Your reviews really do help more people become aware of our show. Our show was produced by Mitch Handley and me, Trey Kay. Ibi Caputo joins our team on this episode as editor. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. Rita Krasoffi and Mariana Trofimova designed our website at usandthempodcast.com and provide us with images for the web. The wonderful people at West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the West Virginia Humanities Council and the CRC Foundation. Next time on Us and Them, a lot of presidential candidates have been declaring their faith in God.
I believe in God. I believe in the Bible. I'm a Christian.
I am blessed to receive a word from God every day and receiving the scriptures and reading the scriptures. And God speaks through the Bible.
It seems American voters need to hear their prospective leaders express a belief in God, usually the God of the Christian Bible. But could they trust a non-believer? Could they get behind an atheist? A 2012 Gallup poll says when Americans consider a president, they're more likely to vote for an African American, a woman, a Catholic, a Jew, a Mormon, long before they'd consider voting for an atheist. In our next episode, a social psychologist tells us why that might be.
I think the idea of an atheist becomes this kind of amorphous, symbolic, almost villain. You have these ideas of no values and no morals and no God, therefore this person can do whatever they want. So it carries ideas of distrust.
Next time on Us and Them.